Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Kathleen McIntyre about her new book, Protestantism and State Formation in Post-Revolutionary Oaxaca, hot off the press this year from the University of New Mexico Press. Dr. McIntyre is assistant professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Rhode Island, where she also serves as the director of the honors program. She's a former American Association of University Women Fellow. She recently participated as well in the National Endowment for the Humanities Women's Suffrage in the Americas Summer Institute. A very socially engaged and very busy scholar, indeed. Dr. McIntyre has taken some time out of her schedule while attending the annual Western History Association meeting in Las Vegas this weekend. So I'm grateful for that. Finally, Dr. McIntyre and I go way back to our graduate days at the University of New Mexico. So I'm delighted to have my very good friend with me today. Dr. McIntyre, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Julian.
Katie, I wonder if you could just start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Okay. Well, I grew up in New York State in Hyde Park, New York, FDR's hometown. And that's an area, the Mid-Hudson Valley, since the 1970s, has had a lot of immigration from Oaxaca. So growing up from elementary school on, I had friends that were from Oaxaca, and I was always really interested in visiting Oaxaca and learning more about migration issues. In college, I went to Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Vassar had a lot of connections with the immigrant community of Poughkeepsie, again, mostly from Oaxaca. So I was involved in some social justice work around issues of immigrants feeling kind of safe and listened to in the Poughkeepsie community. And I also did advocacy work for Latino farm workers. Again, many of them were from Oaxaca. They worked in the dairy industry in the Hudson Valley, or they did onions. And other types of agriculture. And doing that really brought me intimately into what it was like to leave Oaxaca, these very close-knit, tightly woven communities where Spanish often isn't the first language, and many communities that have these really important and very powerful and proud religious celebrations and traditions, mainly Catholic. And so when I would talk to a lot of agricultural workers who, labored in the Hudson Valley, they would often talk about going back for the Saints Day fiesta, for some sort of big mass and religious celebration surrounding the particular saint who their town was named for. So that was always on my radar, this interest in learning more about kind of Catholic traditions in Oaxaca. And when I went to Oaxaca my junior year of college, I also learned that in many of these communities, while they're still heavily Catholic, there was also a growing Protestant population. And sometimes there was differences or conflicts over how these patron saint day fiestas should be celebrated. So that was all kind of going on. And then personally, my family is from Ireland. My mom's right from County Kerry in Ireland. My dad's family is from the north. And I think also from a young age, I was very aware of Protestant Catholic issues in Northern Ireland. Throughout the 1980s, my family was very aware of what was going on during the Troubles. And I remember from a young age just thinking about, in Northern Ireland, there was a Protestant majority and a minority Catholic population, and all of the conflicts that came about where you could find a job, where you couldn't work if you were Catholic, and things like that. So I think religious majority-minority issues were always on my mind. And my own family, my immediate family is quite Catholic. My oldest brother is a Franciscan. He's very involved in social justice issues with Latino immigrant communities in the U.S. He did a lot of his studies and training in Latin America. So he's fluent in Spanish, and he's always been assigned to Spanish-speaking parishes. He's 14 years older than I am. So I think from a young age, I also was really interested in kind of Latino Catholic traditions in the U.S. But I also knew from my brother's work that there also was a lot of Latinos, recent Latin American immigrants, who were leaving the Catholic Church and joining Pentecostal denominations or other churches. So I was interested in that. And I also think in my broader family, even though my immediate family is quite Catholic, and a lot of the Irish traditions that we follow, especially around the Virgin Mary and a lot of the festivals that we celebrate, and sometimes we'll go back to my mom's hometown in Kinmare, County Kerry, for the Assumption of the Virgin Mary and August 15th fiesta. I do have uncles on my dad's side. I have an aunt, I have an uncle who have left the Catholic Church, and they're Pentecostals. And within my own family, even though we're still close to them, it has created conflicts. Will they come to my wedding where alcohol is going to be served? Will they participate in, will they go to my niece's first Holy Communion celebration? Things like that. Will we visit their churches when they're having special revival meetings? Those were all kind of questions that my family had to grapple with. And although, again, we're still close as a family, it did cause some conflicts and sometimes some hard feelings. And so all of that shaped me, that when I started studying the history of Protestantism in Latin America and speaking one-on-one with families in Oaxaca, I felt like some of what they were saying are things that, oh, yeah, that kind of sounds like what happened in my family. What happens if someone is a godmother to your child and then later becomes a Pentecostal and wants nothing to do with the Catholic traditions of being a godmother or godfather? So I would talk to families in Oaxaca where they would say, this was really hard. This person was, my child's godmother, and they had these types of, important responsibilities, and it was great. We were comadres, all of this stuff. And then they left the church. And so that we still have a good relationship, but anything dealing with religion or some of the questions surrounding how I'm raising my kid have become problematic and fraught, right? Will they come to, different parties that we're doing to celebrate La Virgen de Guadalupe or Dia de los Muertos?
Right. What's kind of, really interesting about your book, you certainly come through quite a lot in the book itself. And as you've just pointed out, you've been kind of in this world for most of your life. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, for the book itself, how did you come to write it? You've had this interest in the subject, but how did you come to write this book? What was this genesis?
Sure. Well, so after college, I spent a few years as a social worker. I worked in a domestic violence shelter in Poughkeepsie, New York, and people from all different backgrounds used our services. And I remember meeting a lot of clients who might be from Mexico who had recently converted to, they become Pentecostal or they become maybe a Jehovah's Witness. And they talked about how that there was kind of more feelings of intimacy or a closer connection or more support with the kind of the immigrant experience by joining those congregations, those denominations. So I remember thinking about that. I went to grad school and after working at the shelter for 2 years, I did a master's in Latin American studies at the University of New Mexico. And most of my work there was on human rights issues, particularly around the themes of immigration. I stayed on. I had some wonderful classes with the historian Linda Hall. And so I stayed on for the PhD to work with Linda on 20th century Mexican history. And the reason I got into Protestantism and issues of state formation was that as I was taking coursework and spending more and more time in Mexico, I realized there was a great deal of really good scholarship on Catholic history in 20th century Mexico, a lot of good works on the Cristiada movement, the Cristeros. And I felt like works were starting to come out by sociologists and anthropologists on Protestantism, but there wasn't a lot by historians. Of course, Deborah Baldwin's book that came out, I think it was the late 90s, or I could be wrong on that date, on Protestants and the Mexican Revolution was an early book that really shaped me. But I remember thinking, there's so many good scholars out there looking at Catholics and wondering how issues of migration might be impacted by Catholicism, what happens when most of the men in the town at any given time have left to work in Tijuana or in Chicago, Los Angeles, Poughkeepsie, New York, what happens to social organization and social structures and fiestas. I remember thinking that was really interesting and important, but I felt like nobody was asking, well, what happens if you have a community where most of the people aren't Catholic anymore, or there's a minority, Pentecostal population where that's not really on their radar. So I remember thinking there's not a lot of people asking those questions, particularly in Native communities. And when they do ask those questions, it tended to be a book about criticism of U.S. missionaries who were in Mexico in the 1930s through the 1970s, saying, well, the reason Oaxacans or Chapans have turned to Protestantism was because, you know, these Yankee imperialists came and stuffed the religion down their throats. And they were well-heeled and well-funded. And maybe, who knows, maybe the Rockefellers were funding them. And that's why people converted, but they didn't really want to. And I remember thinking that could very well be true. I'm not apologizing for U.S. Missionaries that came in and probably changed a lot of things and did some harm. I'm certainly not saying, rah, 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 good, that's great that those missionaries were there. But at the same time, I don't think you can say that it's just this purely Yankee imperialist thing, that there'd be no other interest in leaving the Catholic Church if it weren't for those Yankee missionaries coming in the late 19th century or in the 30s. So I remember thinking there's something that's being offered here, something that is very attractive to people to leave Catholicism and join these other religions. What is it? And what happens if you're in a kind of a isolated community, far away from any major towns or cities? What happens if you're one of the handful of families that now identifies as Baptist and other people in the community are kind of angry with you because you've changed some important traditions or you're no longer participating in some traditions? So that's what I was kind of thinking about. And I was wondering, well, how did the Mexican government react to this? Were they okay with Protestants? And how did that change over time? How can we learn more about Native communities' relationship with the federal and state governments through the lens of religion, particularly the Protestant faith? I was also influenced by books such as Todd Harch's book on the Summer Institute of Linguistics. That was one of those Protestant U.S. missionary groups that was in Mexico from the 1930s to the 70s. They were all over Latin America and many parts of the world, and they often had very controversial receptions in those countries. In some places, they were kicked out, asked to leave. In Mexico, in the late 70s, their visas were not renewed, so they weren't actually kicked out, but they de facto were because their work visas were not renewed. So I think that was kind of the genesis of it is, well, what about the Protestants? And again, I was writing at it
writing about it from a historical perspective. Other books that I read about the history of kind of Protestant groups were kind of institutional histories, like, my parents used to go to this Baptist church, so I want to write a little history about the church and how great it was. And that's fine, but I thought that's not really engaging with kind of other historical context or the historiography. So those are some of the thoughts that shaped this book.
Right. And I wonder, you know, you kind of talked about it from the Protestant angle. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the historical impacts of Protestantism have been on indigenous communities. What are the kind of the issues, the long-term impacts, the kind of inclusion or exclusion factors that kind of go along with conversion in indigenous communities?
Sure. And I guess I should first start off by saying that many communities in Oaxaca are governed by usos y costumbres, customary law. And again, it comes from Hispanic times. Some historians would argue it was very much pre-Hispanic times, where within customary law, there's kind of a civil religious hierarchy where different people in the community are tapped for different positions, whether that means kind of being mayor of the town or being in charge of the big patron saint day fiesta celebrations, or even lower types of roles or positions, such as, you know, being in charge of sweeping the streets or the sidewalks, or making sure the school roof, the gutters are cleaned out each year. So all kinds of different roles come into this to customary law. And with customary law, it's has changed a lot now, but generally it was men in the community. The elders would often vote on certain issues. They would vote by, you know, raising a hand or maybe secret ballot about who would be the next leader or who would be in charge of certain duties, certain obligations. And when Protestantism came in, you had some converts saying, well, we don't really have to follow to the T all aspects of customary law because, you know, there's a federal constitution that says we have certain rights and that we don't necessarily have to follow some of the traditions in this town. If I don't want to give some money towards the Virgin of Guadalupe festival for the dance or the drink or the drinks or the flowers in the church, I don't have to. So in a sense, becoming a convert could potentially challenge local rule, local authority, because sometimes converts also became empowered, or maybe you could say emboldened, by Protestant ministers or congregants in towns or larger cities, where they would say, well, you can write a protest letter or petition, you know, the local government, the governor's office, if you're being forced to engage in some sort of activity that seems religious in nature. If you don't want to do that, you shouldn't have to. And if you're being fined or you were thrown in, you know, jail for the day because you didn't do something that was part of customary law, then you can petition the governor, write a letter. And some of the earliest kind of Protestant rights organizations were founded in Mexico City and other big cities. And a lot of them, the founders were lawyers, and they would look for cases. They would look for cases in places like Oaxaca or, say, Chiapas. And they would say, you know, as a Protestant, were your rights violated because of customary law? And they would, you know, this could be in the 1940s or 50s, they would write up a letter and have people in that community sign it, and then they would give it to the governor's office saying that there's this religious conflict, or this, you know, that the freedom of religion guarantees in the Mexican Constitution are being violated there. So I would say, in terms of inclusion, exclusion, certainly customary law could be a problem, because in many of these communities, and there's good reason why customary law was so important, many of these communities had been exploited for centuries, whether it was, you know, the Spanish or, you know, 19th century plantation owners exploiting them for, I don't know, chocolate or or other types of cochineal, other types of products that their communities, their natural resources included. So there was a very good reason why you should stick together in the community and be suspicious of outsiders who are coming in with new jobs or new promises or new religions. And certainly, the 20th century, with a lot of the impacts of the Mexican Constitution of 1917, didn't necessarily make its way up to some of these really isolated communities, unless the reach of the state got there. And so, in some ways, the reach of the state got to these communities because Protestant organizers or missionaries or health officials or teachers would come into those communities and say, hey, you know, the Mexican Constitution says there's freedom of religion, so you can't tear down those people's church. If they want to have this Baptist church and they filled out the proper paperwork with the state and federal authorities, you can't forbid them from holding services. And so Protestants came into a lot of these communities after the Mexican Revolution, after the Constitution of 1917, because with the growth of the reach of the state through health clinics, through the Ministry of Public Education, and other hygiene campaigns, right, vaccine campaigns, who was going to go into these communities? And a lot of times it was teachers, it was healthcare workers, and potentially it was Protestant missionaries. And the Mexican government in the 20s and 30s, for the most part, were very much pleased or to have Protestants set up, kind of set up shop in some of these communities, as long as these Protestants, these converts, as long as they were very supportive of the goals of the post-revolutionary state.
I'm glad you mentioned this issue of kind of, you know, local authority with indigenous communities. You know, you talk about the importance of autonomy, and there's always kind of, you know, in Mexican history, there's always kind of this pull, you know, between the local and you know, the federal. You know, Mexico City and its impact on you know, education, particularly in the post-revolutionary period, was talking about, you know, secularism or education or what you name it. And you have to reference that, you know, that you know, incredibly important you know, edited volume, Joseph and Nugent's Everyday Forms of State Formation, and all those wonderful scholars that contributed to these essays to talk about the different ways that kind of the push and pull between the local and Mexico City kind of in a kind of contributed to this process of state formation. And I wonder, you know, for the uninitiated, right, for listeners who maybe don't know about that larger discussion, I wonder if you could kind of tell us how something like Protestantism fits in with that larger discussion of you know, processes of state formation in Mexico.
Sure. Well, I think in some ways Protestantism went very closely with post-revolutionary goals of integrating indigenous peoples into the, you know, the fabric of the nation, into citizens. So some of the goals of kind of state formation were, and some of the questions were, well, how do you integrate, you know, native populations who for a long time have felt isolated or you know, have felt that they were separate or different from mestizo Mexicans? How do you kind of integrate them into the fabric of the nation? And one way, of course, was through education, right? Mandatory public education or doing outreach to build schools in rural areas and in native communities, and some of the radio schools, the escuelas del radio. How do you get you know, state education out to those areas? And so a lot of Protestants for the 1920s on, and here I'm speaking of Mexican Protestants, they became very active and had high positions in the Ministry of Public Education, right? Moises Sáenz was a Protestant Methodist, maybe. And many teachers who participated, who worked for the Ministry of Public Education, identified as Protestant. And of course, Julian, as you know from all of your good scholarship, so many Catholics were very nervous and to a degree, outraged by many of the acts of public education, some of the schools, some of the rules. And so a lot of Catholics said, you know, well, I don't want my daughter or son teaching for, you know, being a public school teacher. They're basically bringing, you know, secularism to Mexico, if at best, you know, atheism at worst. And we're not participating, or we're not sending our kids. So Protestants would say, oh, yeah, you know, some of the really famous Protestant schools in Mexico were teaching certificate schools, normales. There's ones in Puebla and Mexico City, other areas where they would graduate hundreds each year, hundreds of school teachers who were duly certified. They could certainly teach in Protestant schools, but they were also had certification to teach for the Ministry of Public Education, for SEP, Secretaría de Educación Pública. So you had a lot of school teachers being sent to teach in rural communities and native communities who identified as Protestant. And of course, they could potentially receive backlash in areas that they were sent to, because certainly they were representatives of the state, right? They were seen as these school teachers certainly were a way to view the reach of the state. So that was one way. Certainly nurses and other health officials who were carrying out public, you know, vaccine programs, other things in these communities were other ways of bringing the state into these communities. And I think in a sense, Protestantism tested the strength of the Constitution. How carefully, you know, would federal law be followed in places where, you know, you might be in Oaxaca, you might be in a community that's, you know, 12 hours at best in, you know, some sort of, bus to get to the capital city. So you might have a federal constitution that says, you know, liberty of religion is guaranteed. But what does that mean if you're in a community where the chance of a representative from Oaxaca City getting up there to act as a mediator, they might come, but it might take a couple of months after you've sent a letter requesting some sort of mediation. And in these communities, people might say, look, there's a reason why we've always kind of kept our traditions. There's been examples in the past where we've been exploited, and you know, if you don't like it, just leave. And so you had lots of examples of Protestant converts being expelled from their communities. And so in one of my chapters, I talk about expulsions of Protestants from places like Yosundua and the Mixteca, and in some other communities where they were basically told, you know, if you're going to keep holding your Protestant services, if you're not going to participate in some of our community traditions, we're not going to let you have access to communal firewood or use the corn mill to grind your corn into masa for tortillas. And an important part of many of these communities is tequio, right? Tequio is communal, non-paid work that for centuries, many of these communities did because the reach of the state was not there. So if you had a road that had been kind of torn apart by a storm, or you had some sort of the roof of the school or the church had collapsed due to a bad storm or needed some upkeep, people in the community would get together and they would fix it. And you work together. Maybe some people would make a meal for those who are laboring. Other people would go out there and do the physical labor. Migrants from the U.S. often would, if they couldn't be there to help out with a big tequio, they would send their family some money to give a monetary contribution. And so part of what was going on too is that Protestants started saying, I don't have to participate in tequios. It doesn't say in the Constitution anywhere that I have to do this communal work. It's not paid for. You know, on Saturdays, I go to the nearby town and I sell my rugs or I sell something in a market. I'm not going to give up a day of work to help rebuild the church roof. That's not my problem. I'm not giving money because I'm not Catholic. So why should I have to do it? And the community might come back and say, well, okay, but this building is from the 16th century or the 17th century. We don't want to, it's a part of our cultural heritage. We don't want it to collapse. So even if you don't worship here anymore, you should still do this. So you have conflicts like that. And so if you were a community member in bad standing, where you weren't participating in tequio, you weren't, perhaps following customary law, then you could potentially be ostracized, or you could be cut off from some of the benefits of being a citizen of that community, a ciudadano de bien, a citizen of good standing in the community. So some of the cases I looked at were, it could be Jehovah's Witnesses, it could be Adventists being told, you know, sorry, but we're not letting you come to the mill to grind your corn, you know, you're going to have to leave. We don't want you holding these services anymore. And so I think those were ways that you had, those were some early kinds of examples of conflicts.
You know, what's amazing about your book is that you really, those of us who work on, you know, religion in Mexico and post-revolutionary or any period, we kind of understand the, that of course the exercise of religion, you know, the religious liberty, all these questions are quite contentious. But what your book does is it really kind of brings home the kind of local level contention over what is not, it's not just an act of conversion. It has repercussions within these indigenous communities that that are much more serious, much more severe, right? When you talk about expulsion or, you know, kind of a refusal to, you know, to kind of participate in what is good for the community, where your own identity is kind of tied, regardless of you know, so whether you've converted to Protestantism or whether you remain Catholic, is very important to consider. You're still connected in many ways to the communities that you worked with in the research for this project. And I should say that it's important to kind of understand about Katie's book is that we're not just talking about, you know, she didn't just go to do, you know, historical research in the post-revolutionary period in, you know, dusty old archives. She's employing other, you know, like the majority of us do, right? Or dusty old archives. You're employing other methodologies that really kind of enrich your study in very important ways. Can you talk about you know, the research process that you've done here?
Sure. Well, I think that I had some wonderful support in Oaxaca because I did know a lot of local families going into it because, you know, I was from an area in New York State where there was a lot of connections and ties to Oaxaca. So I did go into Oaxaca already knowing, you know, having kind of a support system there. And I should say that the communities where a lot of the migrants that work in the Hudson Valley are from, I didn't directly do research in those communities because I did want to be respectful of, you know, the close ties I did have in some of those communities. So for example, San Agustin Yatareni is a Zapotec community right outside of Oaxaca City that has tons of migration, high levels of migration to Poughkeepsie, New York. I didn't do any case studies in that community because I thought that was a little bit too close. That was a community where I, you know, spent a lot of time in. I had a lot of good friends, but that was also a community that had lots of religious conflicts. So learning about just kind of the conflicts there did shape the kind of questions I would ask in other types of communities. But I would say what really kind of the methodology I followed was when I started out in the State Archive in Oaxaca looking up just religious conflicts cases. And of course, they had all these different ways to look them up. Sometimes they were called conflictos religiosos. Sometimes they were called conflictos de tequio, or sometimes they were referred to as agrarian disputes. And it all eventually fed back into religious conflict because sometimes the land disputes were over religion that, oh, the Adventist church claims that they have the right to build their church there. And we don't think so. Or, you know, the Baptists refused to participate in this tequio. So those were the cases I was reading. And one case early on about a religious conflict case that struck my attention, that caught my attention was I was reading about a case in Tlacochawaya, a Zapotec community, about a half an hour, maybe closer to 45 minutes, really by car outside of Oaxaca City. And I was reading an article, I was reading a document in the archive about a case in the 50s of religious conflict there. And it kept referring back to the 1920s and 30s and saying that, you know, oh, the roots of this problem in the 50s go back to the 20s when there was this Baptist minister. He was one of our own people. He was a, you know, a native to the community. He became a Baptist. He became a minister. He built this church, and it kept going back to that person and saying this was a huge. And I was wondering, well, what happened? Where, when, you know, who was this person? So I went back and was looking earlier and finding kind of the document trail going a little bit backwards. And at, the more I read, I thought I should visit that community and see if you know, any of these families are still there, because this was Tlacochuaya, was where one of the, it's believed to be the first Baptist church. I know a lot of the Baptist churches are called, you know, First Baptist Church, but this really was the First Baptist Church in Oaxaca. It was built, you know, in the early 20s, and then the minister who, you know, kind of was responsible for bringing the Baptist faith to that community, he was murdered in the 30s by Catholics in the community. So this was, and it was a topic that, you know, was still, people were still writing about it in the 50s and concerned about it, and, you know, kind of some of these religious conflict cases of the 50s. And then I learned that even to this day, there's still ongoing issues. So I visited Tlacochuaya, and I asked to see some of the older Protestant families. And again, I went in, I had connections at the Baptist seminary in Oaxaca. And so I had asked, you know, if they could ask around for me and see if this would be appropriate to perhaps pay a visit to one of the older families. And I was told, sure, that this, you know, one of the eldest Baptist converts in the town, she's really interested in talking to you and letting you know this history, because it hasn't been spoken about in a while, because it was still a very sensitive topic. What had happened in the 30s, what had happened that continued to happen in the community. So I was able to visit a woman, Elvira Garcia, who was, she was from one of the earliest families that converted to the Baptist faith. And she told me the story about what had happened when this minister, Samuel Juarez Garcia, when he had built a church and started evangelizing in the town. And she told me over a series of several visits, several interviews, or, you know, I would come back several times. I was living in Oaxaca for a year, and then I would come back in subsequent visits to follow up with her. And she told me the story, and it was fascinating. And as I listened, it wasn't just a story about a religious conflict. It also was a story about whether or not community members wanted to accept the role of the state in their community, because this Baptist minister was also, he was very political. He was, he had become he was a postmaster in the town, and he was very supportive of the 1920s, the role of the government in the Cristero movement. He sided with the government. The 1930s, he was pro agricultural reform, and a lot of mm-hmm. Catholics in the community were pretty concerned about some of the agricultural reforms that were going on, and some of the new school rules in terms of the increasingly secularization of school. So I don't know if you want me to tell the story of what happened.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask you if there was a good story that you know, or it stuck with you. This is amazing. So and just kind of in context, you mentioned this a little bit. I mean, this is a period in where, you know, tensions are incredibly high, you know, coming sure. right out of the Cristero War, this increasing secularization, the pushing out of the clergy and the church of sure. you know, sort of social life is really important. I'd love you to tell this story. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, sure. So back in the kind of around the beginnings of the revolution, Samuel Juarez Garcia, he was a young man. He was maybe 12 or 13 or maybe 15 in 1910, 1911. He had learned about the Baptist faith through coal porters that had kind of visited his community selling Bibles. And he, as a young man, he converted, became a Baptist, went and studied in northern Mexico, studied at a Baptist seminary. And after things had kind of calmed down a little bit after 1917 or so, he was attending a lot of national Baptist conventions saying, you know, there needs to be more evangelization work being done in Oaxaca. Yes, it's a very kind of Catholic area, but we need schools, we need churches in Oaxaca. So he was given support to start building a congregation, building a church in his hometown, which was San Jerónimo Tlacochawaya, a Zapotec-speaking community, as I said, about probably a 45-minute drive outside of Oaxaca City. So in 1920, he'd been away from his community now for 5 or 6 years. He came back, and he was really inspired by the revolution. He was inspired by the new railroad lines that were now kind of almost finished, and they were finally reaching Oaxaca City and other towns. He was excited about the role of the of SEP in building more schools in Oaxaca, and he started fundraising to build a Baptist church. And it took several years, and it was finally built. It was a small Baptist church. It was built in the mid-20s. But there was constantly conflicts over it, because even though he filled out all the proper paperwork, right, that after the revolution, there was lots of rules about church property, right, that it was property of the nation. So he had, everything had been given the go-ahead from the state and federal government. The church was built. Baptists from all over the country came to help inaugurate it. There was Baptist women's kind of women's groups, Uniones Femeniles from northern Mexico. They had done a lot of the fundraising to help build the chapel and to help get the piano, the organ, and the furniture. So they took trains from northern Mexico down to Oaxaca to celebrate. And so, of course, there was community, people in the community saying, oh my gosh, what's going on here? This is crazy. All these outsiders are coming in. What's going on? And so from that point on, there were a lot of outsiders that would come in, maybe from not necessarily from northern Mexico, but people from other communities that were curious about the church, wanted to attend a service. Sometimes they would sleep overnight in the town. And so the town was becoming increasingly concerned about kind of these outsiders coming in. And also the minister, Samuel Juarez Garcia, he was very much kind of in support of post-revolutionary government goals. So, for example, with agricultural reform issues, he was right behind it. And so in the early 1930s, there was some conflict in some Oaxacan communities about what kind of agricultural land reform stuff was going to happen. He also was big with the women's groups in the town, the Baptist Women's Union, with bringing in kind of more mechanized tools for agriculture and things like more mechanized instruments for grinding corn. So he would bring in, instead of using a metate, he suggested, just like the national government was suggesting, was donating to indigenous communities, he was bringing in these mechanized kind of mills, to grind the corn, instead of kind of women having to bend over with a kind of a rolling pin and having to do it. And so he was pretty much anything that the state government was suggesting. He was their state and federal government. He was right on board with it. He also ended up having conflicts with, there was Catholic groups in the town that were concerned. They weren't, the Catholics that I interviewed in the town said it wasn't really, they weren't necessarily concerned about this new church. They were mostly concerned that Juarez Garcia was very much on board with everything that the state and federal government was doing in the late 20s and early 30s, and that they had concerns. They weren't necessarily 100% pro with some of the school reforms and agricultural reforms. So the Catholics in the community that I talked to said it wasn't necessarily, it was a religious issue, but at the same time, it was a political issue. And so the Baptists in the town kind of remember it as this purely religious issue, and Catholics remember it as, well, it was a political issue at a time when there was very strong conflicts between Catholics and the church, right? As you've mentioned before, with the vestiges of the Cristero movement, you still see that in places like Oaxaca in the early 30s. So anyhow, so Juarez Garcia gets the church built. In the mid 30s, he's murdered. By some Catholics in the town. And the woman I spoke to, she's now passed away. She and her family were very, very interested in my research and wanted to tell their story. So this woman, Elvira Garcia, she was 2 years old the day that the Baptist minister was murdered. But she said, you know, well, I know how this happened. I remember it because my mom was there that day. She was there to use the mechanized corn miller. She was there to get her to grind her corn, and she saw the group of Catholics rush in at maybe 5 or 6 in the morning, and kill him. And the way that Elvira Garcia's mom remembers it was that it was the Catholic women that kind of beat Juarez Garcia to death, that they came in there. And the instrument, and it's very interesting how Elvira Garcia described it. She said that the way that he was beaten to death was with a metate, that they were using those kind of rolling pins to smash his skull and kill him. And that he kind of, he died in his own house right near the layers of, you know, kind of the kernels of corn and the, as you know, he was kind of working and hanging out with other people that were there to use his mechanized corn mill. And that he was, the fact that she, her mother said that it was Catholic women that beat him, and that when he fell back against the wall, he was on top of the corn, the piles of corn that were in his that were in the workshop part of his house, and that the wall was stained from the blood coming from his bashed in skull. And so there he is. He's against the wall. There's blood all over the wall, and he's kind of falling onto the floor on top of all of this corn. So to me, it was kind of, it was very symbolic the way that Elvira Garcia described it, how her mother remembered it, that I thought it was interesting that she remembered it as women going in there. It was a group of Catholics. It was men and women, but it was the women that were really furious with Juarez Garcia. They were the ones that beat him over the head. And that the fact that Elvira's mother remembered that, or you know, described it as him dying on top of the corn, again, for many indigenous communities in Mexico, corn, of course, is very symbolic of life, of so many different things. So that happened in the mid-30s, and there was this huge conflict in the town. Actually, federal troops occupied the town for a little bit. Weapons from, you know, all families were confiscated. A lot of Catholics, including many of the Catholics who I interviewed, they left the town for months, some of them for years. They moved to Mexico City. They moved to other places, to Oaxaca City, because they said that they were so worried about retribution that perhaps the Protestants would come after them, or the federal troops or state police would come after them, because Juarez Garcia was very much a backer of the government. Juarez Garcia was buried. He was his funeral. He was given a kind of a state funeral. His burial was written about in the official government newspaper, the Periódico Oficial. There was a few lines talking about his death and about the funeral arrangements. So from that point on, Elvira Garcia remembers that there had been probably a pretty active Baptist community in the town, you know, still very much a minority, but their minister was killed. The church kind of fell into disrepair. People were kind of nervous about worshiping there. And for decades, the church just kind of became dilapidated. It was just kind of falling apart. Baptists in the town went to other communities that had become Baptist, and that's where they worshiped. And then, there was, again, conflicts in the 50s over that piece of land where the Baptist church was. There was people in the town that said, the church is just, you know, sitting there, and it's kind of rotting. It's falling apart. Let's just knock it over and do something else. Whereas Baptists still had this hope that it would one day be restored, that one day that they would kind of come back to having a thriving, vibrant congregation there. So they fought that and said, no, this land was approved for this church. We hope to restore it someday. We want to work on it. And then fast forward through to the 2000s, Elvira Garcia, is in her 80s. Her daughters started becoming very active in saying, well, maybe we could work with INAH or some other institution to have some funding to maybe put a plaque here. There should be something, because there's nothing here except there's the facade of this church. And it was a beautiful Baptist church, right? For them, it was very important. It was kind of a testament to the important Protestant history in that town that people were increasingly forgetting. And so Elvira's daughters had talked to some groups to see if they could maybe have a plaque there. And this was going on for decades, and it's still going on. They still have hope. Her family still has hope that maybe there's some funding that they can get to do something, to at least restore the facade of the church and have a plaque there. And it's been hard because there's been, there's other families whose land kind of borders with the church, and they're trying to reclaim the land, saying that it's, you know, it's not really being used. And for me, just this kind of the remnants, the vestiges of this Baptist church, it's still there. And you have this family fighting to have its memory preserved. To me, that really stuck with me. And it was interesting because Tlacochuaya, most tourists that come to that town, they come to see the Catholic church. The Catholic church there is, it's huge, it's gorgeous. I think it was from the 16th century. It has a really famous, I mean, just the interior of the church, there's lots of gold inside of it. There's a famous organ that's there. It's one of the oldest organs in you know, musical instruments in Oaxaca, at least for organs. And there's that, you know, building gets a lot of funding, you know, to do renovations, and people, the community are constantly, you know, concerned about renovating it. And so some of the Protestants feel like, well, they know that their church is tiny and, you know, doesn't have the long history that the Catholic church there has, but they still have that hope that people won't forget about that moment, that time when they did have a congregation there, and they keep hoping to restore it one day.
Right. That's a great story. That's absolutely fantastic. And it really does kind of bring to the fore the incredibly contentious nature of religious and religious practice. Katie, we've taken a lot of your time. I had one more question before we wrap up, and I wonder if you could just tell us what's next. What do you have on your research agenda coming up?
Sure. Well, from the first book project, I was really interested in the role of Protestant education, particularly for women and girls. Some of the earliest Protestant schools, Oaxaca, were Methodist and then Presbyterian schools, and a lot of them catered to girls because in the late 19th century, there weren't a lot of opportunities, unless you were rich, if you had money, sure, but there weren't a lot of opportunities for girls to study. So that kind of caught my attention, and that brought me to looking at the role of kind of Protestant schools in shaping women's education. So for this next book project, I've tentatively called it Protestant Women and Political Activism in Mexico, 1900 to 1955. And so education is one part of it. I was interested in the role of Protestant women in education. So from private schools, but also Protestant women's roles in in CEP, leadership positions in CEP. And then also Protestant women's role in suffrage rights. You mentioned in the introduction that I had participated in the NEH's Suffrage in the Americas Summer Institute. And that really kind of influenced me to look more carefully into the role of Protestant women and fighting for the right to vote. And this is often surprising, but in the 1920s and 30s, Protestant women, including some really key suffrage activists, had been educated in Protestant schools, identified as Protestant. So I thought that was a piece of history that was kind of important and needed to be talked about more. So I was interested in the role of Protestant women in schools, in suffrage, you know, voting rights, and also in different areas such as sports too, because Protestant schools, especially girls' schools, became very noted for basketball and volleyball and their success in local and state basketball tournaments. So that kind of brought together all of those areas that I'd kind of come out of the post-revolutionary period and were of interest to me. And this way I can focus on the role of Protestant women and get at questions of kind of what does it mean to be a Mexican, a woman, a Mexican citizen, a woman citizen in the first part of the 20th century.
Sounds like fascinating research. It's going to be great.
Well, thank you.
Again, we've been talking with Dr. Kathleen McIntyre about her new book, Protestantism and State Formation in Post-Revolutionary Mexico, out with the University of New Mexico Press. Katie, I want to thank you again for being on the show. It's been
a
pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Julian.